wieners. It's a war of wieners. It's a war of wieners.
Welcome to Award Winners. I'm your godfather, John, joined by my legitimate legal counsel, David. This is our night at the Oscars, where we watch Oscar-winning movies while enjoying Oscar Mayer wieners. It's a celebration of American culinary and cinematic pop culture. In this episode, we talk about the family crime drama Godfather Part 2, winner of the 1974 Oscar for Best Picture. This is just a follow-up to our first one, which was the previous episode, so check that out if you have not yet. Dave, how are you surviving?
John, I object. That's about the only legalese I know.
Keep it in your pants.
I object for one serious reason. It was not the last episode we did. The last episode we did was Parasite. Godfather was two episodes.
Oh, I forgot.
Yeah, so I'm just keeping you out of trouble, John. You know, I'm helping you not get sent to jail for umpteen years.
I think you should pull me aside and say you need to have a sidebar with me instead of objecting to what I say as my legal counsel.
I'm working on it, okay? I'm still trying to pass the bar.
That's true. You haven't yet. You're the Saul.
Saul Goodman.
New York City.
I think in New York City, you don't actually have to be a lawyer. If you just pass the bar, you can become a lawyer. The problem is you still got to pass the bar.
I think that's true in a lot of places. And I know some of our presidents, that's how they became lawyers, like way back in the day, in like the 1800s. They just studied and then passed the bar. They said, you know, I don't need to go to college.
Being a lawyer back in the day was like being a real estate agent now. Everyone was a lawyer.
I'm pretty sure you had a gun, too.
Walk around. I'll settle this argument with one bullet.
Johnny Law.
So you asked how I was surviving social distancing.
Well, I don't care anymore, Dave. Like, we're past that.
We're past that? Oh, great. Thanks. We're not going to be past it for another 3 or 4 weeks. We're in this for the long haul, guys.
It is true. So how are you surviving, Dave?
I'm watching a lot of movies. I am working on a novella, which is around 40,000 words. And then I've been hanging out on my roof, which I have access to. That's about it. What about you?
Dave, for us normal people, 40,000 words is what? Like a 100-page novel?
Over 40,000 words, like 40,001, is considered a novel. It's a short novel. Or 25,000 words is 100 pages.
So you're like at 150. Yeah. Okay. I gotcha. Yeah. I don't understand your fancy talk, Dave.
No, I get it. I get it. I'm writing a novella. That's what you need to know. And it's a horror-themed novella.
I can't wait.
How are you surviving?
My life hasn't changed because I work from home and never left anyway. I don't notice anything different.
Is that sad?
I don't know. Things that have changed are I can't go to the gym. So I actually ordered weights that showed up. Ordering food delivery on Amazon. In my neighborhood, the Whole Foods delivers just to avoid crowds. You should be avoiding crowds. I saw 90% of people in the U.S. are practicing social distancing. 10% of you are assholes. That's what that says.
But I know where they're from, too.
Well, I know where they went. They all went to Miami Beach.
And they're from Ohio. They're from Milford.
Yeah, that one kid. Oh, my God. What was his name? Like Blaine Stupid or something?
Yes, Blaine Rockhead.
Yeah, it's just like, God damn it, Blaine.
You're making... Someone was like, on Twitter, someone was like, of course Cincinnati produces this asshole. And I was like, that's not Cincinnati. That's Milford. Close to Cincinnati, but not Cincinnati.
Anyway, work's been doing virtual happy hours, which I think has been really good. People are kind of getting together to hang out virtually online just to see someone, talk with someone. I feel like same thing with you. I'm just keeping myself occupied the best I can. I feel like I can catch up on sleep and some other things because I feel like I try to do too much with my time. Now this is kind of good. It slows me down. So it's not a bad thing.
I do want to thank our followers on Instagram and listeners of this podcast. They did reach out to me and ask how you and I were doing. And I told them we are doing as well as we can. And I hope that they are doing the same.
Yeah. If you guys have interesting ways that you're managing this, we'd love to hear it too. That's like a good thing to share at this point. It's just like, hey, what are you doing to kill time? It was my girlfriend's birthday a couple days ago. We had food delivered. I set up a surprise birthday party for her on a video chat. Then we took one of the neighborhood tours. There's historical signs in my neighborhood that you can walk to. So nice. We read all of them because that's one thing that's still open in DC.
The only thing. And are the weed distilleries still open?
Well, I haven't been to a weed distillery, although I like where you're going with that, Dave. A little tincture.
I'm asking because alcohol stores, they're open here. You can just walk in and get some alcohol.
The store was closed. I haven't gone back to look again. I think all non-essential businesses are closed. The bus is running less. A lot of the metro stations have closed also. Part of it is because metro ridership is down about 90% because most people are listening. They are social distancing.
Well, that's good. So, John, have you seen any first-run movies in the last month before they all got booted from the theater?
Dave, I don't even see people. I went out for a walk last night, and I ran into, like, not literally, I tried to stay 6 feet away, one person in maybe a two-mile loop around the neighborhood. I went out for a run today. I ran past a hospital. And, of course, on the sidewalk next to me, and they're not getting the fuck out of the way, there's three doctors in, like, their full PPE suits. I'm just like, what the fuck? Like, if anyone needs to just step to the side and like give me 6 feet of clearance, it's you guys. And they're like right in the middle of the sidewalk, like two by two. And I'm like, God damn it. Anyway, so first run movies. No, movie theaters are closed. I actually wonder how this will change movie releases in the future if things are successful in this capacity. What about you?
I went and saw The Hunt the very last day that movie theaters were open. I was one of maybe five people in a theater. So The Hunt is a movie about a bunch of conservatives being hunted by liberals. It's supposed to be a satire. It's not very good. I wouldn't recommend it. If you remember, it was pulled from theaters last year after one of the mass shootings. It's completely forgettable. Some of the action's cool, but as a satire, it doesn't work. And if you're going to watch a satire, it should probably work. I also rented Bloodshot. Because that was in the theaters. It released like the day everything went crazy. I love that movie. It got terrible reviews. It's not a good film, but it's so bad good. I highly recommend it if you just want to see some things blow up.
Oh, I watched it. I had a different reaction.
That's fine. You know, I'm a Vin Diesel fan. We don't have to agree on everything. I love how bad he is. His brand is so strong.
I like the Chronicles of Riddick, but
there's going to be another one.
Just felt like this was not that interesting. It's like a very generic action film. I feel like we've seen this before.
Oh, we've seen everything in this movie before. It didn't break any ground. It wasn't trying to be the coolest movie ever. And I appreciated it. I needed a mindless movie because I was stressed because we're stuck inside and it worked.
So Dave, how would you describe Godfather Part 2?
I would say it's about the head of a crime family who sets out to find a mole in his family. How about you?
I would say he's trying to make his business legitimate, but he's lost sight of why he's doing those things. So I feel like the first part of the story is all about family, protecting the family, growing the business, making sure everyone's secure. This shows some of the backstory to that. I think he loses sight. He gets greedy. You know, maybe part two is about greed.
The whole film is a tragedy. So yeah, that would make sense.
So if you're a first-time listener, you should know that we eat movie theater hot dogs while watching these movies. David, how's your hot dog dressed on the red carpet this evening?
I have to admit, I have not dressed my hot dog because of self-quarantining. I'm trying to stay away from the grocery stores, but I can tell you what I was going to make and will make as soon as I can get back outside. So I was going to make rice and beans. That is made with yellow rice, onions, peppers, pimentos, which are cherry peppers, tomato sauce. Essentially, you stew that all together with a nice sausage. And I was going to serve it with a strawberry daiquiri. And a strawberry daiquiri will come up in a moment. John, did you actually make your hot dog this time?
Actually, I had plain hot dogs yesterday. Mm-hmm. Just right now, getting out to find supplies. This is like not important, basically.
Yeah, that's why I didn't go out.
So no, but I did make the Dogfather from The Godfather. You can see that online. I actually recommend that. All it is a hot dog with tomato sauce on it and some basil. Turned out to be really good.
It's halfway there to a cheese, a pizza dog.
And I had an Italian sausage on it. It's basically like a sausage pizza. It's basically what it is.
Okay, food facts. So I want to talk about the daiquiri. It is a drink that Fredo orders while he's in Cuba. First off, what is a daiquiri?
It is, hey, Dave.
Yeah.
What is a daiquiri?
What is a daiquiri? You're right. Ask that again. Well, that way we'll put it in.
No, I like interrupting you asking the question.
Fuck you. Okay, what is a daiquiri? So it's a type of cocktail whose main ingredients are rum, citrus juice, usually lime, and sugar or other sweeteners. It is one of the six basic drinks listed in the Fine Art of Mixing Drinks. The remaining five are the Jack Rose, which I have no idea what it is, the Manhattan, the Martini, the Old Fashioned, and the Sidecar. The daiquiri's origin can be traced back to Jennings Cox, and it dates to 1896. He was an American engineer who lived and worked in Cuba. It's believed that he invented the daiquiri after running out of gin while throwing a cocktail party. So he busted out the rum, which there's plenty of in that area, and he named the drink after a nearby port town. However, it's likely that he was the first to put the recipe down on paper, as the island is littered with limes, sugar, and rum. So he basically probably invented something that had already been invented and just named it.
Like most people visiting those islands do.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. You mean Christopher Columbus.
Christopher Columbus.
In 1909, Cox's recipe was brought to the States by a U.S. naval officer who introduced it to the Washington, D.C. Army and Navy Club that helped it gain popularity. And then in the 1920s and 1930s, the frozen daiquiri was invented. And then in the 1940s, America became obsessed with exotic drinks, and frozen daiquiris became the drink of choice at pool and beach parties.
Oh my God. Dave, I just had this like lightning moment and I just realized. So my grandfather was in the Air Force.
Yeah.
This was like exactly when this movie was taking place. He said he was stationed in Florida. They would have to fly to Cuba. Mm-hmm. He was like an engineer on a plane. They would rum run for the officers. And I'm just like, holy shit. Maybe my grandfather was involved in whatever we saw in this movie.
It's possible. Do you like daiquiris?
I don't mind a daiquiri.
Yeah, I don't mind them either. Sometimes the sugar's a bit much, but I would prefer something a little sweet than any of the other cocktails on that I listed above.
Yeah, those are really strong.
So if this was updated to today, it would have a margarita on it, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Or a mojito. Or
unless they fall into the daiquiri subcategory.
We don't have to get into that mess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. But learn, know how to make a margarita. That's important. It's very important.
Okay. I'll,
If you don't know, John, I don't know if we can be friends.
Okay. That's fine.
Okay. Fine. Okay. Last podcast, everyone. You heard it here.
Yep. It's over.
So
Dave, I got to give you the kiss of death and we're done.
Hope there's some dung involved. All right. Do you want to do the movie facts?
So this movie came out December 12th, 1974. The runtime is a very long 3 hours and 22 minutes.
Very, very long.
I think I've watched this movie maybe four times in the last 2 weeks.
I've watched it today.
My God.
Again.
That's so much time. The budget was $13 million, and then the box office haul was $47 million. It was directed by Francis Ford Coppola, and the movie was nominated for 9 Oscars, and it won 6, including Best Director, Best Picture, Best Supporting Actor, which was Robert De Niro, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Art Direction. Oh, and then here's another one on the next page. And Best Original Dramatic Score. You remember the last time there was some controversy?
Yeah, there was, yeah.
The guy got his Oscar.
Finally, good for him.
So this movie went up against Chinatown, The Conversation, which was also directed by Coppola, Lenny, and The Towering Inferno. Dave, have you seen any of those movies?
I've seen them all except Lenny.
I've not seen Lenny either. What did you think of the other picks it went up against?
So Chinatown, I didn't really like it. I like Jack Nicholson in it.
That's Chinatown, Dave.
What did you ask me? The conversation? You asked me about The Conversation?
No, I said that's Chinatown.
Oh,
Dave.
That's I get it.
That's, how, that's
I
the
get
last
it.
Line in the movie.
I'm sorry. It's that's Chinatown, Jake. It looked good. And Jack Nicholson's really good in it. This was at his prime, but it didn't really grab me. I can see why it didn't win. The Conversation, also a super interesting film. It's essentially about technology. And
some guys, basically his job is to listen in and record conversations for legal cases or to spy on people or whatever.
I liked it. It's good. A Lenny, new idea. The Towering Inferno is a giant disaster movie. I haven't seen it in a long time. I remember liking it, but I'm kind of confused why this film is on this list. It's just glaring. It's popcorn film.
I feel like The Rock remade this movie with whatever that was called recently.
Oh, yeah. I mean, basically, I also love that movie.
Godfather 2, Chinatown, and The Conversation are all kind of like these crime noirish films. So it was definitely popular at the time. I've seen those, but I haven't seen the other ones.
And how do you rank them?
The Conversation is low on my list. I thought it was really slow.
Mm-hmm.
I like Chinatown. Do I think it's better than Godfather 2? No, I think they're both equally muddled in their plot points.
Very. That's a very good way to put it.
You just have to watch them a few times to pick up on what's happening, because a lot's going on, and like you'll miss a lot of little things if you've only watched it once. Okay, so other movies that came out this year. This is kind of a big year in film. Young Frankenstein, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Blazing Saddles, Death Wish, Zardoz, which, have you seen that?
I love Zardoz. It's so crazy and insane.
It's also not good. That's Sean Connery in a bikini, right?
It's basically a mankini, yeah, with a bunch of guns strapped to him.
And long hair.
Yeah, just think how crazy it is that both Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles came out in the same year.
Well, it's kind of the same thing over here on the other side where we see Coppola putting out The Conversation and Godfather 2, which are both considered very good movies.
Chinatown's is considered one of the top 10 movies, I believe.
I don't think top 10, top 100 AFI films. And then the top grossing film for the year, Blazing Saddles. It schooled The Godfather 2 with almost $120 million in box office revenue compared to that 47 that The Godfather pulled in.
Yeah. John, am I going to have to advise you of your legal rights because the police are coming?
My ride is here.
Well, direct them towards me when they come up and make sure to invoke your...
I plead the third. I don't even know which one that is.
I plead the second. Godfather the second. What are the cops doing out? Like, there's no one outside. Jesus.
They're probably telling people to get inside.
I can tell you. I also live next to a station, and the number of cop cars and everything going by has drastically reduced.
Okay, so movie trivia. Both Marlon Brando and Robert De Niro, they're the only two actors to ever win separate Oscars for playing the same character, Vito Corleone.
That's really cool.
Coppola did not want to direct the sequel. He actually pushed the studio to have Scorsese do it, but they said no. He eventually agreed. I think they kept giving him more money. He outlined some conditions. So one, the movie had to be interconnected with the first film. It would be called Godfather Part 2. The studio did not like that. That was something they fought him on. And then eventually, obviously, it's Godfather Part 2. He wanted to direct the script for another movie he was doing, The Conversation, which we saw also went up for an Oscar. And he wanted to be allowed to direct the production for the San Francisco Opera.
That's just, he just threw that in, it'd be crazy. He's just like, hey, you know what? If they can make it happen.
And then he asked to be allowed to write the screenplay for The Great Gatsby, which I think also came out this year.
One of them came out around here, but I don't think they used his script. I know he wrote it. I just don't think they used it.
I guess he didn't specify enough that they had to use it. You know, the studio is like a little genie when you're like, hey, I wish for, and then they give you like pretty much exactly what you wish for.
A six-inch pianist?
Yeah. A six-inch pianist. Yeah. So originally the actors in the flashback scenes wore zippers on their pants, and someone pointed out that zippers were not yet invented. So they went back and reshot all those scenes with fly button trousers.
Would you have gone back and done that?
And I would have digitally edited it out. I would have Lucas'd it.
I wouldn't have. Like, too much money. Skip it.
Who would even notice, like, other than some jerk?
I'll tell you, one of our fans who's obsessed with it, someone's on the internet like, oh, this movie's terrible because there's zippers in it.
I wouldn't have noticed. I have to say, I did not notice.
I wasn't looking at crotches.
Production nearly ended before it began when Al Pacino's lawyers told Coppola that he had some grave misgivings about the script and he was not going to do it. So Coppola rewrote the entire script in one night and gave it back to Pacino for his review. Pacino approved the production and it went forward. I saw an interview with Pacino and Coppola later, and basically Coppola said, would you not have done it? He's like, no, I just knew you could have tightened the script up a little bit. You know, this is my way of making you do it better.
There's so many power moves to get this done.
Yeah. All right, Dave, you want to take us through the actors?
So we covered a lot of the main actors in our previous podcast. So this time out, we're going to talk about Strasberg, Gazzo, and De Niro. And they were all nominated for Best Supporting Actors for their roles in this film.
And so we got Johnny Cazale in there too.
Yes, Johnny Cazale. That's right. That's important. Robert De Niro played Vito, as we mentioned previously. So he won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for this role. One of the things I found was really funny is that he is nicknamed Bobby Milk for his pallor. He was named this as a kid when he hung out on the streets of Little Italy. He dropped out of school at 16 to go act. Could you imagine doing that? Like, I don't know what I was doing at 16.
No, I can't imagine doing that.
Playing Metal Gear Solid. Caddying. He had some minor roles in films by Brian De Palma, but his breakout role was Bang the Drum Slowly, and that's a baseball flick. I have not seen it. It looks interesting, but there's only so much time in the day.
They were stuck at home. We're watching that tonight.
No, I'm not watching any more TV. I've watched so much TV, I'm going crazy. He is a Scorsese regular, and so he's been in Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, New York, New York, Raging Bull, The King of Comedy, Goodfellas, Cape Fear, Casino, and The Irishman. Oof. That's a lot. He is praised for his commitment to roles. So, for example, he gained 60 pounds and learned how to box for his role in Raging Bull. He ground his teeth down for Cape Fear. He lived in Sicily for Godfather Part II. And then he worked as a cab driver for Taxi Driver. And one more, he learned how to play the saxophone for his role in New York, New York.
Saxophone?
Saxophone. That's a crazy commitment.
You know, he's one of six actors to win an Academy Award for a role primarily in a language other than English, because most of his dialogue in the movie was filmed in a Sicilian dialect of Italian. So I don't know if he knew that ahead of time or learned it.
I believe I read that he learned it for this role.
Crazy.
Who are the others?
Sophia Loren, Christoph Waltz, Roberto Bernini, Benicio del Toro, and Marion Cotillard.
Got it. I have one more little piece of Bobby Milk trivia. It's not really trivia. It's just something I think is hilarious. He dropped an F-bomb on CNN. I don't know if you heard this, but he was being interviewed by an anchor, and he was asked to respond to conservative viewers coming after him for his dislike of President Trump.
Fuck him.
It's so good. I was like, I love this dude.
Don't mess with the Fockers, man.
Yes. So next up is Johnny Cazale, and he played Fredo Corleone. So The Godfather was his first role, and he had done work in theater prior to this point, and that had impressed him enough that essentially he was written into the conversation. That's another one of Coppola's movies. He was also in Dog Day Afternoon and The Deer Hunter. FYI, Deer Hunter is up next in our movie reviews.
Just a happy film.
Yes, another happy film for these happy times. Unfortunately, he died of lung cancer at a pretty young age, but his legacy is surprisingly influential. Some of the actors who say they were influenced by him include Philip Seymour Hoffman, Steve Buscemi, Sam Rockwell, and Michael Fassbender.
Obviously, he looked to this guy for his Magneto.
Yes. There is a documentary about him. I hadn't had a chance to watch it, but if you're interested in this actor, I recommend you at least go check it out. Next up is Lee Strasberg, and he played Hyman Roth. So he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor in this film, and he co-founded the Group Theater, where he directed experimental plays. He was a major proponent of method acting, which calls on actors to incorporate their own emotions and experiences into their roles. And I believe De Niro asked Strasberg to be in this because he had retired from acting, basically. Finally, there is Michael Gazzo as Frank Pantangeli. He was nominated for supporting actor. He's mostly a stage actor, but also a well-known acting teacher. And he was cast the day before shooting began as a replacement for the actor playing Clemenza.
I mean, so that is the weird thing. So three of those guys were nominated for Best Supporting Actor. I feel like we've only seen that happen maybe two times before up until this point.
Yeah, I mean, studios usually don't want all their actors in one category because it splits the category and someone else wins.
Exactly. Okay, are you ready to talk business?
I have to stretch because this movie recap, I'm going to be honest with you. 3.5 hours, I struggled every time I watched this film. Even the intermission was too late.
Yeah, I guess we'll get into it.
How many bathroom breaks did you take? That's the real question.
Well, considering that I watched it maybe four times, I don't even know.
So many.
Yeah. Especially if I'm like note taking or something like that, I'm like pausing the film all the time and like coming back later. And
I'm not going to watch this movie again for like 10 years.
To watch Godfather Part 3 just to like end it.
I do too. I haven't seen it. Yeah.
I've seen it, but I haven't seen it in a while. I need to just finish it. Movie recap. We're not talking about Godfather 3. We're talking about Part 2. It's kind of two different stories happening in parallel. We're seeing Vito Corleone, the godfather of the whole Corleone family, his backstory, him coming to America, things like that. And then we also see his son, Michael, as he moves the family into a much bigger scam.
expands his criminal organization.
To the international scale. Vito, more local, although towards the end of his life, he's pulling strings in Hollywood and things like that. Here, this is like the next level. He's like messing with senators and things like that. We're getting ahead of ourselves. The film starts in Italy in 1901. We see Vito Andolini, that's Corleone's original name. He's 9 years old. His father's just been murdered for refusing to pay tribute to a local mafia chief. The mafia chief's name is Sicio. Vito's older brother swears vengeance, and he too is killed by this mob boss. So then Vito's mother takes him to this mafia chieftain and says, look, please, Vito is a slow, dull boy. Do you think she was faking that?
Yes, yeah, I do a bit. I laughed really hard, but I was like, I shouldn't be laughing at this, but I am.
Like, he won't seek revenge. Just let him go. I'm begging you. Don Sicio refuses. She holds a knife to his throat, allowing Vito to escape, and she's killed in the process.
It's the most ridiculous escape. Like, a bunch of grown men can't catch a nine-year-old who, they weren't even firing their gun at him. He just, like, sort of hopped over a fence. It's like, later!
That's basically the music that played at that time.
Yeah, exactly.
Then some family friends smuggle Vito out of Sicily, and he gets shipped to America. And he ends up on Ellis Island in the immigration lines. As he's going through the line, they ask him his name. Some guy looks at his name tag. He's from the city of Corleone, so he gets renamed Vito Corleone after the village he's from. Right off the bat, we see some interesting things here. So we see Vito has been surrounded by violence his whole life. It sounds like his father was against the mob. If that's the case, this is an interesting story arc for the family, because their whole story starts out by opposing the mob, and then they end up being the mob. Do you think this is their story arc?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. It's the family story arc is that, but maybe not Vito. Because Vito is the foil of Ciccio. Ciccio is a bad dude. And yes, Vito is a bad dude, but he'll also like help your family out at the same time.
I don't really feel like Vito is a bad dude. I think he's willing to do bad things. He's basically just trying to like make sure everyone is treated fairly, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. He's not out to like really screw anyone. And if he feels like people are not being treated fairly, that's when you see the vengeance come out.
Yeah. Michael, it's a whole different story, which we're going to start talking about.
Right. That's a different thing. We see the scene at Ellis Island. Vito's quarantined because he has smallpox, which is very timely. So it's interesting to see he's like sitting on Ellis Island. He can see New York City from his room. Can you just imagine sitting there like dying on the doorstep of America, even if you've made it that far? He does not die.
Hold on. Let me open my window. I can see downtown Brooklyn, so I kind of get it.
The story actually came from Coppola saying one of his relatives told the story of when they came to America, they tested positive for something or other, and then were stuck in quarantine for a period of time. So this is like a real life story. This really happened.
That's pretty cool.
Okay, so then we switch over to Michael, and we kind of go back and forth, and at a certain point, things start converging more. The year is 1958, so again, we're 10 years out of World War II. We see that the Corleone family has relocated to Nevada. So in the first movie, they took over Las Vegas. So they basically run all of the casinos there.
Oh, Vegas is the worst.
Vegas.
But a lot of money's there. That's a lot of money's there.
During his son's first communion, Michael holds a series of meetings as the Don of the crime family. And then I think a lot of this movie parallels the first one. So just like the first movie, we're introduced to the cast in this setting. We meet a lot of the different people and players. At this party, we see that senators are present. I think that tells us that the Corleone family has legitimized itself a lot, because in the past, I don't think any of those people would have wanted to be spotted with the Corleones. We also see that the Corleone family has moved out of local squabbles with other mafia dons to a much bigger stage. Michael's now pitted against senators and men in positions of power. He's strong-arming the Nevada Gaming Commission to get licenses to operate these casinos. The senator that he's talking to threatens him. If you recall the horse head in the first film, the senator later ends up with a dead hooker. And then Michael is there to, in quotes, help. So again, we just see how powerful Michael really is. And he's like putting these senators in his pocket. He's playing chess. He's definitely ahead of all of these folks. He knows exactly what's going to happen.
I think that's a good thing to chat about right here, John. Michael is playing chess, but Coppola's playing chess as well. So a lot of what's happening in this movie is confusing unless you pay attention and try to think the way Michael is thinking, because he never comes out and says what is actually happening. He lies to people constantly. If you're only half paying attention, I don't know if you get this film.
I would agree. You have to pay attention to all these plot points.
So in the next scene, Frank Pentangeli meets with Michael, and Frank runs the family business in NYC. He's upset that the Rosato brothers, who work for Michael's business partner, Hyman Roth, are encroaching on his territory. Michael declines to help, which angers Pentangeli.
So we talked about this for a second. Pentangeli is supposed to be Clemenza, but that actor, I mean, this is the story that I heard, that actor demanded that his then-girlfriend write all of his lines in the movie, and Coppola declined. So basically, they just, in quotes, whacked that character instead.
The actor who plays Clemenza in the first film, he said that what actually happened was that there are artistic differences. Here's the exact quote from an article I read. Coppola had me losing weight to play Clemenza as a young man. I was down to 194 pounds. When I received the script 5 minutes later, it had me rolling in at 300 pounds. And then here's another quote. The next thing, I saw Coppola quoted as saying that I asked for more money than anyone else and that I asked to rewrite the script. Once the lie gets out, the lie is told and it takes.
It's in the director's commentary.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're the director, I mean, it's in the director's commentary. You're absolutely right.
So those are both sides of the story that we heard.
I know that if I had to drop a bunch of weight and then gain it all back, or when it wasn't allowed to wear a fat suit, I would be really angry. But I think the actor who played Pentangeli did an awesome job.
Yeah.
Michael's motivation for not helping Pentangeli are very complex. So he wants to legitimize his business. To do this, he's working with Hyman Roth to take over the casino trade in Cuba. At this time, Michael doesn't want Roth to think he's going to make a move against him. So he doesn't want to put his thumb on the scale for Pentangeli. Does that make sense?
He doesn't want to make any waves at this moment in time.
Yeah, and you can understand it, because remember, like, Michael's motivation from the first movie until now has always been he wants to take the business legitimate.
Right.
And protect his family. It's these dual motivations. So in the next scene, Connie, Michael's sister, asks him for more money. She's gotten divorced, quote unquote, and she's bouncing from man to man and just spending a lot of dough. Fredo, Michael's brother, has married a woman who doesn't really care for him. Fredo also feels that he is underutilized and treated unfairly by his brother. The Corleones really don't get along, and the family seems to be coming apart at the seams. We also find out that Kay, Michael's wife, is pregnant again, and she asks him why the family isn't completely legitimate at this point, as he had promised. So this is 7 years out from the previous movie when he said that they were going to go legitimate.
We see Michael always telling people that he's done these things for his family. What has this really gotten him? Like, making all these moves, killing people, whacking things.
Money, power, and loneliness. Like, it feels like if he wanted to get out, he could get out almost any way he wants, but he wants to get out with a crap ton of money.
I also think it kind of isn't really for his family anymore, because his family's falling apart. So whatever he's done, it's not helping anyone, really. Like, at this point, you're right. Loneliness.
It's his pride. He's in it because he wants to be the smartest there is.
He's greedy.
He's super greedy. Pride. It could be a mixture of pride and greed, but I feel like Michael just doesn't want to be screwed with.
Yeah, I think you're right.
That night, as Michael and Kay prepare for bed at their Lake Tahoe compound, there is an attempted assassination. Bullets are fired into Michael and Kay's bedroom. They survive, and the grounds of the compound are searched. The two would-be assassins are found dead. Michael sets out to find out who tried to kill him. And to do this, he needs to start visiting members of the criminal organizations he's affiliated with. Before he leaves, he places his adopted brother and family lawyer, Tom Hagen, in charge of the family. So there's something here that I want to point out, and I think a lot of people have pointed it out in other places. Mm-hmm. There's a scene where Kay says, "Who opened up the blinds?" And that triggers Michael to jump over the bed and pull Kay to the ground so she's not shot. I have read that this is a huge plot hole in this film.
Why do you say that?
Let's just get this out there. We're going to spoil the hell out of this. So we all know that Fredo was the person who tipped off Johnny Ola, right? So, So who got into the building to open the blinds? Was it Fredo? Fredo said he wouldn't have anything to do with this. Was it the two assassins who just happened to go into a highly guarded compound and opened up Michael's windows? It seems to me that there would be more than one mole in his organization.
Gotcha. There could be.
Yeah. The whole idea is like, so it's either Fredo or there's multiple people and Michael isn't nearly as smart as he thinks he is.
Or someone else was asked to do it unbeknownst to whatever.
Yeah. There's a million different reasons. I've read several people are like, I think this is a plot hole.
Maybe.
It could be. It depends on how you read it. Like, do you trust Fredo?
We flash back to 1917, which I believe is the year the Spanish flu started. It really hit in 1918, but close enough. We have Vito. Again, now he's played by Robert De Niro. He's married. He has a young boy, which is Sonny. We meet Sonny in the first Godfather. He's now dead. They live in New York City. So Coppola actually wanted Marlon Brando to reprise his role because he was still fairly young at this time, but negotiations fell through. The studio was unsure of De Niro in this casting, and this was considered a risk.
That's insane. He's so good in this movie.
I know. One night, Vito visits his friend. They go to a live show to see a woman perform on stage. She's an actress and singer. Vito's friend wants to introduce him to the woman. When they go backstage, they witness Don Fanucci, an extortionist and leader of the local gang, the Black Hand, threatening to disfigure the actress unless her father, the stage owner, pays him protection money. Vito almost steps in, but his friend stops him. The real play is actually about someone who has to leave his mother in Italy and come to America. I thought that was kind of an interesting little tie-in because it parallels Vito's story. He's had to leave his now dead mother in Italy and come to America.
When I first saw this, I was like, Vito, you're a bad dad. You're just leaving your baby, your little kid to go out with your buddy. Later on, I think that he's a good dad.
Yeah, he actually really is. And you see that he really does care for his family and kids. And there's a couple scenes that we're going to see in a second. Sometime later, we meet a young Peter Clemenza. He basically shouts to Vito from another window saying like, hey, I need you to hide this package, and tosses Vito this bag and it has some guns in it. Vito agrees. Later, Don Fanucci comes to Vito's place of employment, which is a local grocery store. And he basically forces the owner of the grocery store to fire Vito so that Don Fanucci's nephew can work at the store. We see that Vito, up until this point, is a very hardworking man, and he tries to treat everyone fairly. We see Vito buys an orange at some point.
Is it an orange or a pear?
Well, he buys a pear in a second, but he buys oranges in one scene, like he's eating an orange. And we see that ties into the movie several different places. Oranges keep coming up. So in the first movie, when Vito is assassinated, oranges like spill out all over the place. Or when they try to assassinate him. There's another scene when Michael gets an orange from someone when they come from Miami.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So like this orange is just like a weird family theme in some strange way.
Have you ever had someone come to you and be like, here, hold this for me and run off?
No. It's interesting, like side note. My dad, he studied psychology and they ran these experiments. I don't know how you would get this by review board at this point, but they would ask someone to hold a box for them and then just go away and see. And then they'd have someone else observe how long the person watched the object before leaving.
How long do you think you would make it?
I don't know. Not that long. Especially in this day and age, you asking to hold a package? Fuck no.
I would look at my time. You got 10 minutes, bro. Then leave in 5.
The answer is you get zero time. I was in the laundry room of my basement and they're like, oh, I forgot, whatever. Their stuff is done in the dryer. They're like, I'll be right back. Be right back can be anything from like 5 minutes to 25 minutes. So I take their stuff out. leaving. They're like, why didn't you wait? Or they like see me coming back. And it's like, does it even matter? Your stuff is in your basket. Like, why did you run off?
Why did you? That's great. Why did you leave? I don't understand. That happened all the time when we were in the dorms together. Yeah. People taking stuff out of the dryer. That's an exception. I understand that rule. Take it out if they're not there.
There's also the scene on his way home. I really like the scene. So Vito buys a pair with his meager earnings and brings it home to his wife. And she's like, oh, that's such a nice pair. Oh, that's really sweet. He cares about his wife and his family. And that's the best thing he can do for her at this time. Right?
Bring her a pair.
Buy a pair.
Who's my pair? I'm going to bring you a pair next time I come to DC. Just walk in. I got you this pair, John.
I like a nice, like crisp, one of those like Asian pears. That's what I want, Dave.
I'm sorry. You're only getting it in the can.
All right. So Clemenza then shows up and asks for his guns back. As a thank you, he wants to do something nice for Vito. So they go steal a carpet together.
This is one of the most famous scenes in the entire movie, right?
Clemenza and Vito go to this nice house. Clemenza says, my buddy's not home. We'll just let ourselves in and take the rug.
Liar.
It's clear that they're robbing them. In this scene, a cop shows up at the house and like knocks on the door.
Yeah.
And they hide, and Clemenza has a gun pulled, ready to kill the officer if he comes in and finds them. So this really could have gone poorly and really taken Vito into this life of crime, which in a way it does anyways.
Yeah. What do you think is going through Vito's mind? Because he's like, I was just going to get a rug, but now I'm an accessory to a burglary and almost a murder.
Well, he did hide some guns for that guy.
That's like, true.
Right off the I guess we don't know what he thinks, but maybe he sees how Don Finucci operates and is familiar with these mafia dons even back home because he's always been exposed to them as men of power. And maybe this is his way up.
Yeah, I think that too. I also think it's sort of implied that he has no job and does this because he needs money. He just has no money, has nothing going on. So he's like, maybe this will turn into something. I'm also projecting a lot.
I think it's fair because we don't really know.
And that's kind of the problem of this movie. You don't really know about anything.
I think it seems very reasonable.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So we switch back to Michael now.
Let me put on my Michael voice. It's my normal voice. I'm going to do this in Italian.
Please do.
Vino. Give me another Italian word.
Pasta.
A pasta. Vino.
Oh, my pasta. The Pope. I don't know.
We're terrible. We're terrible. Yeah. To all our Italian listeners out there, we love you. We love you. Okay, so Michael. Michael believes that Roth was behind the attempt on his life with the help of the mole in the family. I don't know how he comes across this. He just decides it. So that's a huge leap in logic. Michael travels to Miami to meet Roth to suss out details and make Roth think that he blames someone else in the assassination attempt. At the meeting, Michael says that Frank Pentangeli wanted to take out the Rosato brothers, and that when he refused, Pentangeli tried to kill Michael. Michael tells Roth that Pentangeli is a dead man. This, of course, is a huge ruse.
And this is exactly the point you were making earlier about yes. confusing plot points in this movie, because if you didn't watch this movie four times like I did, you would not understand any of this.
Yeah. There's a scene earlier that we didn't quite touch on when he's talking to Paul Hagen, and he's like, I think Roth did it. And then Tom Hagen, Paul Hagen. Who the hell's Paul Hagen? Paul Hogan.
I don't know.
but basically, like, he just says he thinks Roth does it. And then he goes, talks to Roth, and you're like, what is happening here? I'm so confused. In a more conventional film, it would have been like, okay, we're going to get our muscle and we're going to go assassinate him.
But maybe part of this is also to lead to some mystery in what's going to happen in the film. Just like people in Michael's life, they don't know why he's doing all the things he's doing. So we are also led along with the ruse because we don't know better. I'm not sure if that was intentional or not.
I'm not either, but it's a really interesting take on the character because no one can figure out what's going on in Michael's head. So we, the audience, are experiencing what everyone else would experience when they're around Michael and watching Michael. That's a really interesting take. Michael then travels to New York to meet with Pentangeli. He tells Pentangeli that he needs to end the trouble with the Rosato brothers.
My father taught me many things here. He taught me, keep your friends close, but your enemies closer. Now, if Hyman Roth sees that I interceded in this thing in the Rosato brothers' favor, He's going to think his relationship with me is still good. Agavit.
Agavit.
That's what I want him to think. I want him completely relaxed and confident in our friendship. Then I'll be able to find out who the traitor in my family was.
This is also one of the most famous quotes from this film, or in film in general. And that is, keep your friends close, but your enemies closer. This quote is often misattributed to Sun Tzu, but it's from Godfather 2. Just letting you know. I see it all the time. I looked it up and everyone's like, no, that he did not do this.
What Wall Street bro is responsible for that?
The same one who has a big sign that says greed is good, even though they're the villains. Or the same person who doesn't understand Glengarry Glen Ross, that Alec Baldwin's character is the villain.
Donald Trump.
Mini rant. Yeah, Donald Trump. Yeah. Power tie wearing motherfucker.
Yeah.
Do you genuinely agree with keep your friends close, but your enemies closer?
No, I don't hang out with anyone I don't like.
I mean, you have to have like people in your life. You're like, I need to monitor them because I know they're a wild card.
I don't really hang out with those people, I guess. I don't know.
It's more like if you're forced to interact with them, not hanging out.
I mean, at work, I guess sometimes you got to like keep an eye on
some people. I know what you mean.
Like, there's some people who will go rogue and you kind of have to know what they're doing because it's going to cause a lot of problems.
If you give them leeway, they go crazy.
They'll throw you under the bus too. So like you got to, you know,
I work with someone who's that constantly. Yeah. They're like trying to always, they fucked up stuff constantly, blaming on everyone else. Oh, the worst. All right. So Fredo gets a late night phone call from Roth's business partner, Johnny Ola. Johnny says that Pentangeli wants to meet with the Frizzato brothers to make peace. Johnny wants to know if Pentangeli will come alone or if he'll bring his men. And it's clear that they're planning to kill Pentangeli if they can. On the call, we also learn that Fredo told Johnny something that would get him in trouble with Michael.
Do you think Fredo is just a dumbass? Or maybe he's just frustrated in venting and giving things away?
I think we're meant to understand that he is a dumbass. He means well and he was a little bit frustrated and he didn't think there was going to be an actual assassination. But that also gets back to my plot hole point where if he wasn't the one actually trying to kill him, then there's another person in that building. What do you think? You think he's just a...
He thinks he's going to be made the leader of the family if Michael dies, which is definitely not going to happen. He's going to get whacked.
He's going to get whacked sure. Within the hour.
And then someone else will take over. I don't know who that is. It could be Tom. I don't think Tom would outright whack Fredo. Tom probably makes the most sense for the next person in charge.
Okay. So when Pentangeli arrives at the bar to maintain Michael's facade by making peace with the Rosato family, they attempt to kill him. The killers lie, saying that they've been instructed to carry out this hit by Michael. You know this because they mispronounce his name. The hit is foiled when a police officer wanders into the bar. A shootout ensues with many people dying, but Pentangeli survives and ends up in police custody. I'm very confused by this scene because I have read that this was all a ruse by Roth to get Michael in trouble. But I don't know if I believe that. Get him in trouble with the law, I should say. Having the police officer walk in on purpose and they weren't actually going to kill him just to put Mike on the crosshairs of the FBI and the Senate.
Could see that.
Yeah, but we don't know.
It's unclear to me. Yeah, I agree. I don't know.
First time I saw it, I read it as they just screwed up. They screwed up and he accidentally survived. Roth like wasn't thinking five moves ahead like that.
I kind of agree because the shootout follows with the police and a bunch of these guys in the street with people on both sides getting killed. You would just assume that he would pay a police officer and the guys who were trying to whack Pentangeli. It would have been better coordinated.
Michael, Roth, and Fredo, along with several other gangsters, travel to Cuba to form a partnership with Batista, who is the Cuban president. This will allow him to operate casinos in Cuba without interference. In exchange, they're giving him a bunch of cash up front. So they will all be massively rich if this deal goes through. Roth says that if he dies, Michael will take over running this business.
So in this scene, I looked a couple of these things up. There's the solid gold telephone that gets passed around the room from this American phone company, ITT. This actually happened. ITT came to Cuba to bribe Batista with this gold phone, basically. a solid gold heavy phone. And it is actually considered the symbol of Batista's corruption in Cuba, this gold phone. As a note, the scenes of Cuba were actually filmed in the Dominican Republic. I did some digging on Batista. So before I went to Cuba, I was just learning about the history of Cuba. He was a very corrupt dictator, and he made a lot of deals with famous American gangsters to allow them to operate casinos, brothels, and drug rings. And he turned Cuba into a police state in which 20,000 Cubans were murdered. The U.S. government was largely complicit with this, which then led to the Castro Revolution. So the Castro Revolution is our fault, just to make that clear. In addition, drugs, be it marijuana or cocaine, were so plentiful at the time that one American magazine in 1950 proclaimed, "Narcotics are hardly more difficult to obtain in Cuba than a shot of rum, and only slightly more expensive." As a result, the playwright Arthur Miller described Batista's Cuba as hopelessly corrupt, a mafia playground, and a bordello for Americans and other foreigners.
So it's a grown-up Las Vegas?
In a way, but I think it was even worse because like all these foreign nationals were coming and basically just abusing the locals, women, and doing whatever they want and getting away with it. Not only was it Las Vegas, it was like Las Vegas with an oppressed people.
Ugh, it's terrible. I hate our people, John. So we're going to continue this scene. Michael also sees the Cuban rebels in action and realizes they are more determined than the police. And this causes Michael to delay investing his money in the deal. Basically, he's like, these people are willing to kill themselves for freedom. What's going to stop them from blowing up our casinos? Fredo and Michael head out into Cuba to grab a drink, and they catch up for the first time in a really long time. And Michael reveals that he knows Roth is going to try to assassinate him on the trip. But Michael has already put a plan into action. Michael confronts Roth about the hit on Pantangeli, asking who ordered it. Roth tells him a story about the death of one of his men and friends at the hand of Michael. This was Mo Green. So in the first movie, Mo Green was killed, and Mo Green ran Las Vegas. Roth has a heart attack after that and is moved to the hospital.
Do you think he fakes this heart attack, Dave?
No, I think it's real. This part is really hard to grasp a little bit because Roth is like, I do this for business. But then he also kind of says, you killed my best friend, Mo Green.
And didn't say anything. You need to let this go.
Exactly. We both have stuff going on. The gangsters all go out on New Year's night, and they're led by Fredo, who's going to show everyone a good time. Because honestly, this is what Fredo is good at, just partying. There's a scene at a sex show where we see Superman, and this is a guy with a giant dong.
So this is based on a real story. Coppola said he dug this up in some fashion. There really was a guy with a giant cock named Superman that you could see fuck in Cuba.
There you go.
This is exactly the excess we were just talking about.
Remember that the internet did not exist at this time.
So what are you saying, Dave?
I'm just saying it's a lot easier now. You don't have to go to Cuba. Fredo, when asked how he found out about this club, accidentally reveals he had heard about it from Johnny Ola after previously saying that they had never met. Because of this slip, Michael realizes that Fredo is the mole in his family. The group ends up at the presidential palace, where Michael confronts Fredo by giving him the kiss of death at midnight.
There's a plane waiting for us to take us to Miami in an hour, all right? They'll make a big thing about it. I knew it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart. You broke my heart.
Dave, have you heard a moment like that where you felt betrayed in such a way that you're like, ah, you broke my heart, Fredo?
Oh, definitely. It's not so much what someone did either. It's what they didn't do in the moments. I thought we were better friends than this. I guess we aren't. How about you?
Yeah, I think I had something happen somewhat recently where we had just, a betrayal of trust within the family. And I think we're still trying to figure that one out.
It's going to take years and it'll never be the same.
Yep. Yes. They haven't been whacked yet, but maybe it's coming.
Great. Well, as your lawyer, I would recommend you not do that.
They're going to get whacked out of the family and maybe cut out of the family.
Okay. Yeah, it's a really bad position to be in. It sucks, but you learn to deal with it, which is the most adult thing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be different, though, if someone tried to have you assassinated.
No assassinations were attempted.
Yeah.
As far as I know.
So in the next scene, Michael's bodyguard has been sent to eliminate Roth in the hospital, but the Cuban soldiers kill the man during the attempt. At this point, the Cuban Revolution has begun. The locals are storming the casinos and destroying the palace.
The locals are storming the casinos to destroy the places that made Cuba a living hell for them. So
yeah.
Casinos were the symbol of this corruption. So we see Batista resigns. He does flee the country. Apparently he takes like $700 million with him, the entire wealth of Cuba.
How do you even fit that into a briefcase?
I don't freaking know, man. So then Michael has a plane waiting for him, and he sees Fredo as they're trying to flee from the party that they're at and tells him to come with him. But Fredo runs off into the night, fearing for his life.
This is a really complicated and interesting scene because Michael says, "You're still my brother." But at this point, knowing Michael, I agree with Fredo. You can't trust Michael. Remember in the previous movie, he said he wasn't going to strangle Connie's husband, and he killed him anyway.
Every time he, quote, forgives someone, he forgives them by whacking them.
I really do think that Michael loves him, and in that moment maybe wanted him, but there's going to be a time down the line where he's just like, you know what? I've been stewing on this. Whack him. There's also a point, and it's in the sacking scene, that I find hilarious, and I think if you blink, you'll miss it. There is a scene where some random guy has like a stick or a baseball bat, and he hits a post, and it ricochets, and he falls over. I rewound it like 3 times to watch it. I was like, Coppola, this is the only reason you put this scene in here, just for this ridiculousness.
Probably.
In Roger Ebert's original review of this film, he said that there was a lot of fluff and pointless scenes, and he specifically pointed to this scene, the sacking of the casinos, as an example of stuff that you're like, this doesn't need to be here.
Probably cut out a lot of the stuff. Even some of the interactions with Fredo and Michael here probably could have been shortened quite a bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And even that whole night out, unneeded.
Yeah, you could have done it pretty quickly. You didn't need to tell Fredo what was going on.
We later learned that Fredo and Roth both escape Cuba separately by boat. Back home, Michael learns that his wife Kay has miscarried while he was away in Cuba.
Yeah. Sad. Michael really wanted a boy.
And we'll get into more of that in a second. So we go back to 1922. Vito now has 2 more children. So that's Fredo and Michael. We see one of the children crying because they are sick as a powerless Vito looks on.
I believe this is Fredo. I thought in the first movie they said that Fredo had gotten sick when he was younger, and that's one of the reasons why he was slow. And this was showing the audience this is how he got sick.
Okay.
That's what I put together in my head. My head canon.
Makes sense. So I think this is where Vito decides he'll do anything to make sure his family is cared for. So mm-hmm. at this point, like, they're just very poor. They're trying home remedies to help the child. He feels powerless in this moment. And he's like, I never want to feel that way again. I think that's how I interpret this scene.
Yeah, I think that's very good. The look on De Niro's face is so strong. And you see him fretting and worried about his child. And you see him doing this. And it's a juxtaposition with Michael. Because Michael says he loves his family. He never has that look on his face. It's always like, I think this is part of the theme.
Yeah, that's good, Dave. I also think this is where De Niro won his Oscar.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this whole scene. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we find out that Vito has started a small criminal business with Clemenza and his friend Tessio, where they're stealing dresses and reselling them. Don Finucci, the local crime boss, learns about the business and demands a cut of the profits. We find that Don Finuccio is really just extorting everyone in the neighborhood. He's kind of not giving anything back to these people for the protection that they are paying him for.
The protection is from him.
Yeah.
It's very different than the protection that's provided by the Godfather.
Vito tells his partners about Finuccio's demands. They're afraid because they've seen what he's done. But Vito says, I take care of everything. Just like that. Vito gives Finucci the money that they owe him, and then they separate, and Vito stealthily follows him home. So there's this festival that's going on in the neighborhood. When Finuccio gets back to his apartment, Vito assassinates him and takes the money. Vito then heads back to his family and tells baby Michael that he loves him very much.
This is another example of not quite knowing what's going on unless you're paying super attention, because Finucci wanted $200. Vito told his partners that he wanted $600, and he got them to give him $100. And then he said, he took that money and gave it to Finucci, saying, well, this is all I have. So he literally got his business partners to pay the bribe without him giving up any money.
Yep. And then he whacked.
Yeah. And then he whacked him.
And did he keep the money? It sounds like he might have.
I don't know. It looks like Clemenza may have been like somewhat involved because he said that no one was home at Finucci's apartment. But it's just another example. If you're not paying attention, this doesn't make any sense. You have to put yourself in the mind of the criminal mastermind. They're not going to spell it out for you.
We then see Vito take over the neighborhood. For discussion, Dave, what do you feel the difference is between Finucci and Vito?
So we talked about this a little bit earlier. So Finucci is taking and not giving back, and he's violent. I'm not saying that Vito is not violent, but Vito, it's more like, I will help you out and you will owe me a favor. And that favor may not necessarily be money, but when the time comes, I'll cash in that favor. We see this in an example in the first movie when it's just cremating his son. Or it could be, you have to go stand outside this thing. With Finucci, it was all about money. It was all about power. I felt like Vito was more honorable and attempting to actually make people's lives better.
So do you think Vito's killing of Finucci is justified?
I think so. It was along those lines that sounds like Finucci was going to keep pushing and keep pushing until he gets as much money as he wants. He gets more than what he deserves. And he was making the lives of everyone miserable. Do you?
I think that would happen, or he would end up trying to kill Vito because Vito wouldn't pay him anymore.
Yeah. One thing I also want to point out is that it feels like he gave him the money as a way to give himself an alibi. People saw him give him the money, so they knew that he'd already paid and they wouldn't think that Vito did it.
Wouldn't you think he would want people to know that he did it?
I don't know. It's very unclear with like the structure of the Black Hand. Like, you would think if your boss was murdered, there would be other people in the wings ready to take over.
The Black Hand is interesting because in the scene at the beginning when they're in that playhouse, they call him the Black Hand. Sometimes it feels like it's Finucci's nickname, and sometimes it feels like it's the name of his mafia. It's unclear to me what the Black Hand really is.
I'm also confused. Let's assume that it's maybe just him. He's called the Black Hand because he wears gloves and they give him money.
It ties into the Marvel universe because the Hand are a bunch of ninjas in New York City.
They are. That's a good point. I didn't think about that.
Michael, is he more like Finucci or Vito?
He's more like Finucci, 100%. When do you see Michael doing anything positive for the neighborhood, for his people?
He gives a bunch of money to people at the beginning of this movie, and they sing a song to him saying he's like the greatest guy alive.
I mean, maybe. I still think he's more Finucci. He's just extorting everyone.
But I still think he's got a bit of a code, and I don't feel like Michael's ever bad to people that are... that don't deserve it in some capacity, I guess.
I mean, he had a woman killed to set up the senator.
That's true.
That's something I don't think Vito would do.
Okay. Intermission.
It's the bottom of the seventh inning. The last chance to order beer. But we didn't come here to drink beer. We came here to win this ball game. I said to the Uber boy, I said, take me out with the crowd. And in order to sing the right lyric, take me out with the crowd, you need to sing it like our greatest American entertainer, Mr. Daffy Duck. So I want you to spray it and don't say it. A one, a two, a three. Take me out to the bar.
Oh, God, I needed it. I'm going to go run a lap and come back because we still have 2 hours left. Oh, how are your legs? Good from that seventh inning stretch?
Yes. I love singing that song.
Yeah. Take me out to get a hot dog. Let me tell you, John, hot dogs at a ballpark are the best hot dogs.
It's because they're $15.
You pay for hot dog flavor. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
I had one when I was in Florida a couple weeks ago. Delicious.
Are you into some preseason games, or?
I went to a preseason game. I went and saw the Braves versus the Red Sox.
Dave, that might be more baseball than anyone else gets this year.
That's true. I didn't make it to a single baseball game. Yeah,
I've been to that stadium down there in Florida. So they have like a fake monster.
They do.
Built out of chain link fence.
They do.
Yeah, it's cool.
It was a great experience. I was sitting next to some Buckeyes who talked to me about football as I watched baseball, and I had a delicious, delicious hot dog.
All right.
All right. But back to our movies, moving sports aside. So Michael was brought before the Senate committee, and he is questioned about whether he is the head of the Corleone crime family. And he denies this. He denies it 5 times in a variety of different ways, opening himself up to perjury.
Vito, back in the 1920s, has become a respected member of the community. This is demonstrated when an elderly widow comes to him to negotiate with her landlord to let her stay after she breaks some rules. The landlord initially declines, but then he learns who Vito is. I really like this because Vito actually goes to this landlord and just tries to negotiate with him as a normal person would, just say like, hey, she's an old lady, she doesn't have anyone. She's really sorry. How about if I give you like $5 or $10? Would it be okay? Eventually, he tells the landlord, look, you're just going to agree to this. I'm going to give you like $30-$40 up front for her rent for a few months. And I never forget a favor. This guy realizes who Vito is and comes back and sort of apologizes.
What I love about this scene is that when the guy finds out who Vito is, he has this stammering exchange in Italian and he can't get out the door. And none of it is subtitled. You just know that he is freaking out. He's like, this guy will murder me if I don't get out of this room.
Their initial reaction is when he asks the landlord to do this, he says to Vito, I'll kick your Sicilian ass.
Nope. I also like that this is all over a dog. This old woman wants to keep a puppy. And Vito's like, let her keep the puppy. It's a save the cat moment for Vito. And it's one of the reasons why we like him as a character much more than Michael.
Okay, so Vito then starts an olive oil importing business, and that's basically the front that brings him money. And this is the company that was put on trial by the Senate committee hearing in the previous scene.
So we're back with Michael. Fredo has returned from Nevada, and he has states that one of the Senate lawyers is on Roth's payroll, and that, surprise, Pentangeli isn't dead, and that he's going to testify against Michael. He confesses to Michael that Roth's right-hand man, Johnny Ola, had promised to reward him for information about Michael. Fredo also says that he resents being passed over as the head of the family and giving meaningless jobs. Michael responds by disowning Fredo, and he tells his capos that nothing will happen to him as long as their mother is alive. A little bit later, Kay reveals to Michael that she actually had an abortion, not a miscarriage.
It wasn't a miscarriage. It was an abortion. An abortion, Michael. Just like our marriage is an abortion. Something that's unholy and evil. I didn't want your son, Michael. I wouldn't bring another one of your sons into this world. It was a son, and I had it killed because this must all end. I know now that it's over. I knew it then. There would be no way, Michael. No way you could ever forgive me. Not with this Sicilian thing that's been going on for 2,000 years.
Oh! You won't take my children.
I will.
You won't take my children!
You're my children.
So the power imbalance in this relationship is very real. Kay basically feels like the abortion is the only way she can get even with Michael in any capacity. But also she feels like she doesn't want to bring kids into this like terrible life.
In the next scene, Pentangeli comes up to testify. Michael has his plan and he brings in Pentangeli's brother, Vincenzo. And the implication is that if Pentangeli rats out Michael, they're going to kill his brother. A scene breaks out in the court and everyone wants to know what's going on. But essentially, Pentangeli just says, you know, I told the prosecutors in a written statement whatever they wanted to hear to get this over with. Michael has nothing to do with this. I don't know what's going on. He is not the head of the family. It ends up being a sort of a mistrial.
it all gets dismissed. It's a mistrial because their star witness, he's gone off script.
I like how the senators are like, what's going on here? Who's this guy? And Tom Hagen's like, he doesn't speak English. Can't ask him anything. Were you confused about jumping on to this scene from intermission? Just like coming straight up on it.
Why did you feel there was some confusion?
There was no implication that there was a Senate trial happening. It just all of a sudden went to the trial. It wasn't like someone walked into a room and said, you know what, Michael, there's a Senate trial happening and you have to go there. It was just Senate trial is happening. He is testifying before the government.
Gotcha. Yes, that is like a sharp transition.
Yeah, this was the most jarring thing to happen in the film for me.
I will say I did not need the exposition to explain that it was going to happen because it's already a 3-hour and 27-minute movie.
Yes, there's a lot of things you could cut out of this film. Yeah. All right, let's go to Vito.
So the year is 1923. Vito travels to Sicily for the first time since emigrating to the U.S. Vito and his business partner meet with Don Ciccio. And remember, Don Ciccio is the guy who has killed his father. The purpose of the meeting is for Vito to ask the mafia chief's blessing on their olive oil business. Instead, Vito kills the man with a knife, getting his vengeance. Interestingly enough, the family was brought along on this trip, although they did not come to the murder. They were like back in town.
This is like you and your family going to Disney World, and your dad's like, I'm going to duck out and murder a man at Burger King. Or your mom, who knows? But that takes some huge balls. Do you think he needed to do this? Do you think that Vito needed to travel back to Italy to get even?
No, I don't think he needed to at this point. I think he felt like justice needed to be served. But even at this case, he's like a sad old man at this point.
And that old man was right, though. He's like, if I don't kill the son, he's going to come back. But he also maybe created a self-fulfilling prophecy there. I like this scene. It's also the scene when he stabs Ciccio and drags the knife up is really gory. For some reason, you don't see that in films where they like drag the knife. I sort of shuddered.
It's not a pleasant death.
And afterwards, they all went and got ice cream. Sorry, gelato. What's the weirdest thing that you've ever done on a vacation?
It's a hard shift. The weirdest thing I've ever done on a vacation. Like, what counts as weird? I think when I was in Houston, I went to the Funerary Arts Museum.
Oh, okay. That's weird.
So it's just like a bunch of hearsts, and they have full-size diorama displays of what happens when the Pope dies. Maybe 10 or 15 rooms of like chambers and recreations of tombs for popes.
I thought you were going to say Ripley's Believe It or Not, John.
No. It's also in like a really uncomfortable part of town because I stopped to get gas there. And someone tried to sell me crack.
That's what Vito did. Just imagine that's what Vito and his family did afterwards.
What's the weirdest thing you've done on vacation?
I was trying to think about what we were talking, and I don't have a great one. The most uncomfortable I've ever felt on vacation is when I was in Thailand in October. I just stuck out like a sore thumb. I'm 6 inches at least taller than everyone, and it felt like poverty tourism. I did not have a good time. I had a good time, but I have mixed feelings about it. Let's put it that way.
I hear you.
So Michael, Carmela Corleone dies. This is Michael's mother. And Fredo freaks out because he knows his days are numbered. He begs to see Michael. At the funeral, Michael appears to forgive Fredo. We also learn that since fleeing Cuba, Roth has been refused asylum in several countries. He is forced to return to the United States. Against Tom Hagen's advice, Michael sends a hitman to murder Roth as he arrives in the States. The hitman achieves his goals, but is killed in the process. It's also a really interesting scene because Tom Hagen goes, we can't kill this guy. He's impossible. The feds are going to be there and get him as Susie steps off the plane. And Michael's head of security says, it's hard, difficult, but it's not impossible. And here's a newsflash for you. He died. So it's impossible. It's not. Okay. It wasn't impossible, but was it worth it? Probably not.
Goal achieved, I guess you could say.
I read somewhere that Michael wanted his top man to go do it because he also maybe blamed him for the assassination attempt because he was sloppy. I couldn't tell. There's a lot of guessing of Michael's motivations out there on the internet.
I can see why he would do that.
But again, we're guessing. We don't actually know. Afterwards, Tom Hagen visits Pentangeli and speaks with him about how failed plotters against Rome emperors often committed suicide to assure their family to be taken care of. Later, Pentangeli cuts his wrists in the bath and bleeds to death. So essentially, Tom Hagen was like, if you eliminate this problem for us, which is yourself, we'll make sure everyone turns out okay. Do you trust Tom Hagen?
Yes, I think Tom Hagen would help out his family. And I think Pantangeli realizes I wasn't double-crossed by Michael. It was Roth that pulled this, but he didn't realize that until it was way too late.
That's sad. I really like the Pantangeli character, and I love that actor. I felt for this guy as much as you can feel for a criminal. Meanwhile, Michael has Fredo shot by one of his men while they are fishing at the Lake Tahoe estate, and Michael watches as the deed is done from his window.
So that's like Michael's signature move. He's just like, yeah, I forgive you. And then he waits a little bit till they feel comfortable and then he offs them.
You mean he's petty?
He just like never really forgives or never really means it.
He never means it. He's waiting to strike. He's waiting to the opportune moment. With his mother dying was the last of his real family connection.
And his sister is there and sort of back in the picture at this point too.
Apparently she has a bigger role to play in the next film, but I haven't watched it. Do you think Fredo deserved it?
He did try to have Michael killed kind of several times at this point.
Did he though? That's the crux of the argument.
I mean, assuming he did, because he sort of did in the first movie too, right? Didn't he do something?
He caused his father to be shot. He wasn't with him.
But like there was like one other one in the first movie where he basically did something that, well, whatever. Do you think he deserved it?
It's a really hard discussion, but if we were going to make this black and white, I don't think you can trust Fredo. I think Fredo is a good guy, but he as much as you can be a good guy. But I don't think that he is fit out for a life of crime, and he's not smart enough, and he's going to cause other people to get killed. And so
he's a liability.
He's a liability that Michael got rid of, and Michael gets rid of liabilities. And his father wouldn't have gotten rid of the liability. He would have found something for him to do, which would be send him to Las Vegas, I guess.
We flashback to 1941. So this is a few years before the first Godfather film starts. The Corleone family has gathered for a surprise birthday party. It's Vito's birthday. There's a bunch of people from the first movie sitting around a dinner table. Vito's not yet there. And Michael announces that he's left college to enlist in the army, which infuriates Sonny. Sonny and Tom say that Vito had plans for Michael. And Michael basically says, look, I want to be the master of my own destiny. Vito is then heard at the door because we do not see Marlon Brando in this scene. And the family gets up to go greet him. Marlon Brando was scheduled to return for a cameo in this flashback scene, but I guess due to the way Paramount Pictures treated him during the filming of the first Godfather, he decided not to show up. And Coppola rewrote the scene overnight. Coppola said that he struggled to figure out what to do, and that this was the way to do it.
Everyone on this set seems like such divas.
Yes.
Everyone, like every single person.
We flash back to Michael. You know, the movie ends with him looking out over Lake Tahoe alone from his massive estate.
I believe he looks older because it's supposed to be in the future, but you don't really know that. You would have to have read the notes about it to understand that. John, we did it. He made it through both Godfathers.
Well, there's a third Godfather.
We're not recording a podcast about the third Godfather. As far as everyone, our listeners go, it's over. There is no ending. Do you need an ending? We already know this. You know what? Let's move into this movie discussion and we'll get to that in a critique. So movie discussion, what are some themes that's going on in this film? So for me, the first one is family. Vito's purpose of becoming the Godfather was to make sure to keep his family safe. And Michael says that, but it seems that his purpose and reason for being the Godfather is to accumulate power and to amass as much power as possible. It's greed.
The story is about family, you know, through these two different story arcs. The first one is about making sure the family's safe. And the second one seems to be the opposite of that, the family coming apart. Mm-hmm. So that's how I would say, you know, this is story arc part two, family comes apart.
We also touch on levers of power.
Levels
of power, yeah.
I mean, what's your favorite lever of power, Dave?
My favorite lever of power has to be an elevator, John. Okay. They get you so high.
Yeah. Okay. So levels of power is another theme. We start with small neighborhood crime bosses and move our way up to senators. At every level, you know, we see Michael trying to achieve the next level. But at every level also, there's just corruption and villainy too. So there's bad senators, bad actors. It just gets worse and worse with every step.
I saw them talking about legitimacy. This is more touched on in this movie than the previous movie. It feels like it's a theme that goes across both of them. Michael, he wants to get out of organized crime, but either can't or won't. And we touched on this a little bit. I think that he just doesn't want to be out of it. I think he actually enjoys this.
In the third movie, the famous quote I believe that he says is, "Every time I try to get out, they pull me back in."
But think how easy it would be to get out. He can just take a bunch of money and be like, okay, now you're in charge. I'm leaving later. It really feels like greed is keeping him in, at least to me.
I get that. I also wonder, if he leaves, does he give up all the protection that comes with his place of power? You know, will his enemies come and kill him if he decides to move in another direction?
He retires, and then Roth shows up to get revenge for Mo Green. And then Michael wouldn't have anyone with him. Patriarchy. We talked about this last time. Again, Italian families are mostly male dominated. Michael is really obsessed with having a male child to bring into the family. To me, it feels like he's trying to recreate the bond that he had with his father. Problem is that he's not Vito.
He does have a male child already also. He just wants more.
John, did you see anything else?
Nope.
Okay. What did you think of this film? Why did it win?
The acting is strong. I feel like they took some source material and really fleshed it out. So the writing also had to come through. Music, sets, all those things were very well done. So it is a very well done movie.
My initial reaction on the first watch was, fuck if I know why this won. To me, it's a very difficult movie to wrap your head around. But if you forced me, exceptional acting, exceptional set design, I would quibble with the writing, though I think the themes are very good. I did enjoy this film, but it's a lot to get through twice in a week, and I'm not going to watch it again for a decade. So let's critique this film. How are we supposed to feel about Vito and Michael? In some sense, to me, these characters, the director feels ambivalent towards these characters. Did Coppola take a stance on this? Like, are we supposed to root for Vito? Are we supposed to root for Michael? Are we supposed to not root for Vito? Are we supposed to hate Michael? What's going on?
He's just trying to get across the change in values from one generation to the next.
That's interesting.
The question about rooting for one or the other, I don't know. I feel like maybe we're meant to root for Vito.
That's how I feel too. I mean, Vito feels like he is the quintessential American story, even if he's part of the crime. He comes here as an immigrant. He builds a business out of nothing. He comes successful. He has a family. Michael, he has everything handed to him and just tanks it.
Well, he doesn't tank it because he takes it to like the next level. It's like massive. They own Vegas. What he fails at is keeping the family together. And I think he loses sight of the original intent for all of this, which was to make sure that everyone mm-hmm. was protected and loved and taken care of, because he's really not doing that anymore.
No, he doesn't do that. He's just taking care of himself.
He's ruthless.
Yeah. Oof. Why do people gravitate towards Michael as a character? I feel like part of our society who sort of worship him.
The power, I guess.
I mean, he's a very smart character. I mean, he is a mastermind. He can play people like a fiddle. But I guess they're ignoring the part about him also being somewhat of a sociopath.
I don't think he's a character that I gravitate towards. So I don't get that. I mean, I sort of get it, but at the same time, it's not for me.
Yeah. I mean, everyone wants to be good looking and smart and rich. Those are like the three things,
basically.
Right? Okay. Do you have any other critiques of this film?
I think they could cut some things down. We could shorten the film. That would be my biggest critique.
It looks really good, though. It is a pretty film.
Yeah.
All right. So is this a winner or a wiener?
I think it's ultimately a winner. There's a lot of very memorable moments from the film, which makes it a winner.
So I agree with you. I think it's ultimately a winner, but it's very long. You have to be ready to watch it when you're going into it. You have to pay attention. It's good. The question, though, is it underrated or overrated?
Overrated.
100% overrated. There's no way that this film is in the top five.
No, it's not. It's in the top 100.
Let's keep going down. Would you put it in the top 10?
No.
Top 25?
No.
Top 50?
Maybe.
I'm with you. Again, it's good. I don't understand why people love it as much as they do. Do you think this is as good as the first one?
I think it has different qualities. Mm-hmm. I think De Niro's acting surpasses a lot of the acting in the first film.
Mm-hmm.
That is my feeling on that.
I think I like the first one better. I know that this is supposed to be the example of the better film. the rare example of the sequel being better than the original. I think I like the original better. Do you have a porn name for us?
I do. Two Godfathers, One Cannoli.
That is really good. That's really good, John.
What do you got?
The Dong Father Part 2. I'm just going with what we had last time. You know?
Okay.
It's good.
Looking at the DVD, I guess I had the Blu-ray release. It had some commentary on it. I found the commentary to be very interesting. I think Coppola does a very good job of keeping you entertained with his dialogue. If you're into it, check it out.
How many? There's like one director's commentary, two. There's just what's on?
Just
there?
One for this one. I think there were two for the first one.
Okay. So, feedback. Really, it's housekeeping. I recorded a podcast with Movies, Films, and Flicks. We did Tammy and the T-Rex. If you enjoy really amazing B-movies, this one's starring Denise Richards and Paul Walker and an animatronic T-Rex, go check that out.
I have not seen that. Maybe I'll have to check that out.
It's on Shudder.
I did hear something from one of my friends. He listened to our Parasite episode. We both missed this, but looking back on it, it's pretty funny. I feel like we might spoil things. I'm going to spoil them. So you should go watch Parasite. Maybe skip ahead like 1 minute in our podcast if you haven't yet. Apparently there's a scene when the original housekeeper comes back and she's sort of holding the family hostage. Apparently she's acting like a North Korean dictator. Like all the broadcasts that come out of North Korea that are broadcast to South Korea. She's like playing that role really well. Like all the propaganda films, the right motions and exactly what she's saying. So I missed that because I don't really watch North Korean propaganda films. But
are you sure? Or you watch American propaganda
well,
films?
Well, I guess I don't know. Maybe I am. I just thought it was really funny. Going back and looking at that, you're like, oh, yeah, that's a good little gag.
You know what? We haven't had a good old-fashioned award wieners political rant in like a couple weeks. So here's a real quick rant.
Uh-oh. Okay.
President Trump, his daily coronavirus updates are filled with lies, and media organizations should not publish them because they are complacent in spreading lies and misinformation. Should be like the very small organizations who have stopped doing it and are instead putting it out later with corrections.
Well, we have Dr. Fauci to put Trump in his place.
As best as he could. That guy has the hardest job in the world right now.
I think he's doing great.
He is. He absolutely is.
What do we have up next? You already told us, Dave, but remind our audience.
We're going to do The Deer Hunter. The person who won our Oscars pool selected this movie. I do not know why. Such a Debbie Downer.
Have they seen this movie before?
Yes. Everyone has seen this movie. Not everyone.
I find it hard to believe that everyone has seen this movie. I feel like it's a more obscure film in
really?
The Oscars list. Don't you?
I don't know. Not at all. I think it's one of the biggies.
I don't think so. It's yep.
We'll we used get to get it. Drunk, John, and you would hit me in the face and go, "Mow!"
That will only make sense in our next episode.
That will. That will. All right. So if you liked our podcast, please, please, please rate and subscribe. You can follow us on Instagram. We do a lot of fun stuff and games throughout the week. You can contact us at David@AwardWieners or John@AwardWieners.
Thanks for listening in. Just imagine a doorway with a camera pulling out and the door shutting, because that's how this podcast ends. It's just like at the end of every Godfather film. There's always Michael sitting at his desk. The camera pans out and the door shuts.
Yeah.
Business is going to be conducted.
Business has it. All right.
We'll talk to you all later. Stay safe. Wash your hands. In a pot, we get a doozy, the mullah's a lot. You're getting used to me doing no wrong. I don't play chicken, you prick, I'm a fox. You wanna kick it, I'll give you the rod. You kiss the wood chipper blade if you bark. I'm fucking magic, in fact, I'm a warlock and talk. I got a unicorn on cross. Stop. Woo.